You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll continue our candidate forums with Spencer Zimmerman, a Trump conservative candidate for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, we look at a story about a Green Bay clerk and her thoughts about opening a new polling place, the latest on teen pregnancy rates in Milwaukee, and news about Wisconsin's voucher schools.
Robert Menser is back with us again to walk us through the week's biggest stories. He's the storytelling editor for USA Today Wisconsin. Robert, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Well, Robert, there was news out of Green Bay this week after an email exchange between a city clerk in Green Bay and the state's election commission was made public. What happened?
So this was tied to a release of emails in an open records request by the Liberal One Wisconsin Institute, and essentially they found kind of a smoking gun. It was written up in The Nation. It was an email from the Green Bay City Clerk, Chris Teske, complaining about this request to establish an early voting site on the campus of University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. She wrote to the Wisconsin Ethics Commission to ask whether it was okay to deny this request on the grounds that students lean more toward the Democrat is the sort of killer quote. So what's interesting is she was writing the email to ask the question, is this a valid reason to deny this as an early voting location? And she's sort of asking, isn't this an unfair partisan advantage? But there's no recognition that it could be an unfair partisan advantage to Republicans if Wisconsin has city clerks looking around for ways to deny early voting based on sort of partisan calculations.
Well, right. That's what's interesting about this is that just some people have taken that and seen an attempt at suppressing the student vote, and other people have said, well, she was just trying to avoid giving any part of an edge to the other party, Republicans in this case. How do you think this ended up playing out in our hyper-political landscape right now?
Well, so it's custom made for confirmation bias. If you see voter suppression, then this is a great example. But I mean, there's some truth to it. It is important. It's probably important to complicate the picture, because it is important to say that Teske also in her email does cite actual budget and staffing concerns. She cites accessibility to the campus, to whether that would be useful as an early voting site. It's also important to say that, you know, UWGB students can go and vote early at City Hall just like anyone else. You have to go to your polling place on election day, but for early voting you can go wherever. So it's not just about partisanship that what she was talking about, but it's just that there's clearly this partisan dimension that underlies it, which is why this is a story in The Nation and why it's been talked about in political circles in Wisconsin all week.
And to finish the story, was the polling place at UW-Green Bay ever opened?
It was not. For what it's worth, the Wisconsin Ethics Commission seemed to reply to the clerk in a sort of above board way and say that you're not obligated to open a polling place here. That's not really a reason that we would give. That will be a polling place on election day. Students can are welcome to vote. We had a reporter on campus today this week talking to students about their reaction to the story, and there are a lot of people who were offended by this and said that it only increases their resolve to vote. So I think their voice will be heard.
We're moving on to some good public health news right now out of Milwaukee. The teen birth rate has dropped. Apparently in 2015, the journal Sentinel reporting that it was at a historic low for 15 to 17-year-olds. What's the latest there?
Yeah, it is probably not an overstatement to say that the decline in teen birth rates in the last, couple decades is one of the biggest and clearest public health gains of the century, and maybe longer than that. So this is, we have new data in Milwaukee. The Journal Sentinel reported on an announcement the city's health department made today, which is historically low birth rate among girls aged 15 to 17 years old. The city's teen birth rate since 2006 has declined 65%. It was almost 24 girls out of every 1,000 had a baby between the ages of 15 to 17. Today, it is down to 18 out of 1,000. The birth rate has gone down among all ethnicities, and the movement's been relatively consistent through the years. There's some movement, but it's been fairly steady in the way that there's no reason to think that these new numbers are in any way an outlier. They seem to be part of a larger trend.
So 65% drop since 2006, that's really significant when you look at that. And you have to ask, is there a reason? Do we have a handle on why the rate has dropped so much? What's working?
So, again, this is true in Milwaukee. It's also true across the nation. And so as with any large trend, it's got to be overdetermined. There's got to be multiple contributing factors. What we know is that abortion rates have not gone up during this same time. In fact, there are fewer abortions today than there have been in decades. So it isn't that. It seems to be some combination of effective use of birth control. Emergency contraception use is up. That is a factor. And effective education campaigns. It seems crazy, but one factor that some actual social scientists point to was the popularity a few years ago of the MTV reality show Teen Mom. You talk about the Teen Mom effect. That was a show that depicted some of the actual realities of being a high school student who has a kid. And there's a thought that's in the mix as one factor among others, it showed this sort of unromantic reality of what that's like, and maybe that got through to some kids.
We're talking with Robert Menser right now from USA Today Wisconsin. We're recapping the biggest stories out of Wisconsin this week, and we're going to switch over to education now. So there's been news this week about Wisconsin's voucher schools, Robert, and in short, spending on state voucher schools is the program in general is expected to go up in the next year. What kind of growth are we talking about?
Yeah, significant. Wisconsin will spend $245 million on private school vouchers for this school year, 2016-2017. That is an increase of $15 million from last year. This reflects enrollment increases in Racine as well as in the statewide voucher program, which was set up to each year to allow a few more students to increase up to a certain cap. The cap increases and in fact, enrollment has followed that cap. It amounts to a little less than 34,000 students statewide, and so this is an increase.
Are there particular parts of Wisconsin where voucher schools are growing more quickly than in others?
Well, so the Wisconsin has a weird system. It always, in Milwaukee and Racine, they always have had a different type of program than what the rest of the statewide voucher program, which is relatively recent in sort of the Walker era. The Milwaukee program is actually one of the oldest, it might be the oldest school voucher program in the U.S. And so these are the places where there's the most just raw numbers of students getting vouchers, and also there's been a lot of growth there. The idea, of course, is that the purpose of a voucher in the premise of it is that you give a parents a choice among schools, and that there might be some private charter schools might be able to pioneer some different teaching methods. They might be able to scale up and improve sort of overall education levels. And then, of course, it amounts to a very controversial program because people say it undermines public schools to take these students as well as, of course, these funds.
And what has this meant for public schools that might be affected?
Well, so, I mean, I think there are a lot of public school administrators who would like to have a piece of that $245 million that the state is spending on vouchers for their own districts, especially given tight budgets, and we're seeing all over the state put referendum pushes in local school districts. It's not so clear, because in fact there have been gains in public schools as well, and it's not really been the case that vouchers have outperformed public schools. That is, the studies on this are complex and they point in some different directions, but overall it's not it just has never happened that that these private schools receiving vouchers consistently perform better. That's just not the case. But I think for sure there's a sense that that for every voucher something's taken away from public schools. At least that's that side of the argument.
And Rob, just briefly as we wrap up, looking to the future, what do you see for this tension point on funding between voucher schools and public schools here in Wisconsin?
Well, the statewide program continues to go up. It increases the statewide cap for each year for 10 years, and then there is no cap. We're a few years into that. That path seems to be set. At the same time, lawmakers are gearing up to work on the next state budget and have already said that providing more funding for public education is going to be a priority. I think it's very likely that K-12 education gets some more funding in the next state budget. So it's really a question of whether it's perceived as sufficient, whether it's perceived as taking the pressure off local communities that need to do referendums so they have less need to do that, or if that pressure still exists, if that friction still exists, then I would assume that school vouchers, some resentment about the funds that are spent there will continue as well.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Wisconsin. He joined us there to recap the biggest stories out of Wisconsin this week.
We're talking to another candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District in our continuing candidate forums. The district includes Kenosha, Racine, and other cities in the southeast corner of the state. Spencer Zimmerman is the Trump conservative candidate in the race. He's running against Republican incumbent and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan from Janesville, Democratic candidate Ryan Solon, and Libertarian candidate Jason Liebeck.
Spencer Zimmerman is in the studio now to talk about his candidacy. Spencer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with a basic question. Why are you running for Congress?
Sure. After graduating from high school in 1998, I enlisted in the Air Force for 4 years and was stationed at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. I was on duty during the 9/11 terrorist attacks. I was part of a security response force and received the Joint Service Achievement Medal for my actions that day. I've always wanted to support my community, always wanted to serve. It's why I joined the Air Force, and politics seemed like a natural progression. When new evidence recently emerged implicating several foreign governments in the 9/11 attacks, I felt compelled to seek public office and call for a new investigation. I also believe in term limits, and the same person has represented the 1st Congressional District since 1998.
And in terms of the party you're running with, the Trump Conservative Party, that may not be a name that's familiar to many people. What is a Trump Conservative?
Well, when running for office, you can choose to affiliate yourself with the two-party system, Republican or Democrat, or choose a principle statement not to exceed 5 words. Trump Conservative began as a principle statement that defined me politically, and since launching my campaign, I've received support from across the country, so maybe in the future there may actually be a Trump Conservative Party becoming a reality. But I initially used the term Trump Republican in my original campaign registration statement because I am a Republican, and my support for the Republican presidential nominee was why I decided to run as a Trump conservative. And I support the entire Trump platform, the entire Trump policy statement. And as the only candidate in this race that supports Donald Trump, to vote for anyone else would be to vote for someone who would undermine a Trump presidency.
In terms of your policy as it relates to Donald Trump, are there any differences or is it a complete agreement?
No, I'm in complete agreement. In fact, the one area where one of my first priorities that I listed my priorities for Congress, and number one was term limits. And just recently on October 18th, Donald Trump announced his support for term limits. He's going to also push for a congressional constitutional amendment to impose term limits on all members of Congress. And that's something that I believe in. I believe we need a term limits constitutional amendment limiting senators to 2 terms, congressmen to 8 years, just like we have the president term limited. I believe that reform would do more to change Washington than anything in the 200-plus years since the Constitution itself was ratified.
And looking at your district, the 1st Congressional District, what do you see as some of the most important issues facing that area?
Well, obviously, the economy is a very important issue, and especially in Janesville, because we recently lost a GM plant. In Kenosha, there used to be a plant where they built Chryslers, and we've seen our manufacturing base decimated here in Wisconsin and across the country. NAFTA has really been devastating, and I believe we need to renegotiate or leave NAFTA and stop TPP, this new trade deal, and my opponent is a supporter in those trade deals that have really cost so many jobs across the country. We've basically seen the manufacturing sector just completely decimated by these trade deals, and I really think that it's time to implement some new renegotiate these deals and make sure that the American worker is being looked out for. And I want to man the watchtowers of the nation and make sure that we're doing whatever we can to protect American workers when we negotiate these trade deals.
You mentioned trade deals there, and the economy has been a big issue in this election cycle and previous election cycles. Is there anything else you want to add about what you would do if elected to help grow the U.S. economy?
Sure. Well, Donald Trump actually told Ford that if they built a plant in Mexico, he's going to charge them 35% in every car, truck, and part that they import in the United States. So I would support imposing tariffs on Chinese Mexican automobile manufacturer, if there's automobiles being manufactured over there, we need to make sure that these companies, that they pay a price if they outsource jobs, if they move manufacturing to Mexico, to China. We need to make sure that they pay a price. So I believe that if we can't renegotiate, then we may have to impose those kind of tariffs.
We're talking with Spencer Zimmerman right now. He's the Trump conservative candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District, joining us as part of our candidate forums here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And I want to ask you about some of your platform here. You've said that you want to preserve the English language by requiring new American citizens to speak English. You'd like to halt illegal immigration and secure our state by building a wall along the southern border while permanently deporting illegal aliens. So with all that in mind, what kind of plan would you propose to accomplish all that?
Well, it really comes down to national security. We need to know who's coming into this country, and especially at a time when we're facing ISIS, the terrorist state in the Middle East, it comes down to making sure that this country is safe. And building a wall, I believe we need to, I mean, if you want the actual specifics, it's a 35-foot precast concrete wall. Construction is estimated to cost around $8 billion, and the money is going to come from reducing the $50 billion trade deficit that we currently have with Mexico. So Mexico will pay for the wall, and, you know, it's really... it's a 2,000-mile border, but there's natural boundaries, so only about 1,000 miles of the border will actually be necessary as an actual wall.
Do you support any kind of path to citizenship for immigrants who may be here illegally?
They'd have to go back in line the way everyone who goes through the process legally has to go through the process. I don't think that they should get a free pass. I don't think they should be able to jump in line just because they broke the laws of this country.
Now, looking big picture, one possible election outcome, Republicans could keep the majority in the House, Democrats could control the Senate and or the White House. Would you be able to help create bipartisan legislation that both sides could agree on?
Well, if you're talking about compromise, if you're talking about making the kind of concessions on core values that Paul Ryan has been making, then I don't see myself making those kind of compromises. During the omnibus negotiations, conservatives lost out on defunding Planned Parenthood. We lost out on blocking Iraqi and Syrian refugee resettlement. We weren't able to overturn Obama's executive actions on immigration. So I will stand firm on those core values, those core principles. And I will negotiate with the other side to achieve an outcome that's successful for conservatives.
You were talking about Paul Ryan, and briefly, as we wrap up, what is your take on how he's done representing the American people during his years in office?
Well, my question is, where is the accountability with what the Obama administration has done in the last 8 years? There's, I mean, clearly now the FBI is starting to investigate the emails again, but why haven't there been congressional investigations? Why haven't there been indictments or any impeachment proceedings during these years? You know, checks and balances are supposed to be provided by Congress, and instead it seems like Obama's been given a blank check by Paul Ryan and the Republicans in Congress. So I think that it really comes down to accountability. We need to hold this administration, hold the Obama administration, hold Hillary Clinton responsible and accountable, and we need to bring them to justice.
Spencer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Spencer Zimmerman, Trump conservative candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District. He's running against Republican incumbent and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan from Janesville, who we invited for an interview. We've also had Democratic candidate Ryan Solon, who was on the show with us yesterday, and Libertarian candidate Jason Liebeck, who joined us earlier this afternoon. You can find more information about our candidate forums and all our election and politics coverage at WPR.org. 141 people were arrested in North Dakota amid ongoing protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline. The underground crude oil pipeline is designed to transport hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil per day from North Dakota to Illinois. It's been the site of protests for months by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and 90 other Native American tribes who say the pipeline threatens the water supply and could destroy sacred tribal sites.
Let's take a listen to one of the protesters. Here's a clip of Robert Eder of Fort Yates, North Dakota, who spoke to a Prairie Public Broadcasting reporter.
We won't have it anymore. We won't have it anymore. This is our stand. We'll stand and we'll stop this pipeline.
Dave Thompson is the news director at Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota and joins us now to tell us more. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Bring us up to speed on the protests today. Is the tense standoff between police and activists still going on?
It is still going on. It's a little less tense than it was yesterday. Protesters have retreated away from that private land they were on, land that the developers of the Dakota Access Pipeline bought. You know, they set up a temporary camp on there. They've been moved off of the camp. They're back toward the main camp, the Seven Clans camp, which is close to the Cannonball River. But there have been a few touchy moments between law enforcement and the protesters. It hasn't broken out into anything violent at this point. People are keeping their distance, but there is still some tension.
There were reports of some protesters throwing Molotov cocktails, officers using rubber bullets, police brought in armored personnel vehicles. What tactics are police and protesters using here?
It's a lot of more show than anything else, because except for one report of three shots that were fired close to a line of police, the shots missed. It looks like people are just trying to intimidate each other right now. It's a case of police are trying to keep the peace. There are protesters who are trying to push their limits. And it's kind of like the immovable object versus the irresistible force.
What do we know about the people who were arrested, 141 people arrested? Who are these people?
The vast majority of them are not from Standing Rock. They're from out of state. There are a lot of out-of-state people here, not only just Native American tribal members, but also environmental activists who are here, and there have been a number of arrests of out-of-state folks. About a handful have been from Standing Rock.
Remind us how we got to this point of such tension and protests. What do the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, what does the tribe want, and where is pipeline construction at right now?
Pipeline construction is very close to the point where they will be crossing the river. How they will cross the river is 70 to 100 feet below the river. Now, the river is Lake Oahe at that point, which is a man-made reservoir. So there's a lot of water there. And the Standing Rock Sioux are very concerned that pipelines could leak and really harm the water supply. Not just for them, they say, but also for people downstream on the Missouri. Pipelines are, like anything else, is not 100% effective, but the Dakota Access Pipeline supporters will tell you that since they're burying it quite far underneath the waterbed, that and they have special safety devices that have been put on the pipeline, shut-off valves, that it is as safe as possible. One reason they're doing this is because of all the publicity concerning shipping oil by rail and all the fires and explosions that have been, you know, have gotten some publicity, most recently near Castleton, North Dakota, and, of course, in Quebec.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has really been front and center on these protests. What are tribal leaders telling you about what may happen?
Tribal leaders are communicating a lot. They're hoping that eventually the pipeline will be shut down until they can find a different route, maybe away from the Missouri River if possible, because it would go from the Bakken, which would basically north of the Missouri, and would cross Lake Sakakawea and then come down and would cross Lake Oahee. The original route of the pipeline, or one of the original proposals, would have had the pipeline going north of the Bismarck-Mandan area, which is a metropolitan area of a little over 100,000. The pipeline company and regulators determined that was not a good route. Basically, some real problems with drilling under the river at that point. And so they moved it a little further south, and the pipeline itself is not going over tribal land at this point. It's going north of tribal land, but the tribe is concerned that a leaking pipe could contaminate the water.
We're talking with Dave Thompson, who's the news director at Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota, who has been, of course, following these protests, reporting on what is happening at the site of these protests at the Dakota Access Pipeline. Dave, what about these sacred sites that these tribes are also concerned about?
Now, this is a matter of a bit of contention between the pipeline and the tribe. The tribe says areas to the west of the main area we're talking about have sacred sites there. Archaeologists from the state of North Dakota and from the Dakota Access Pipeline folks, Energy Transfer Partners, have been to the site, and they say these are not sacred sites. So that's a bit of contention right now. One of the tribal archivists has said, yeah, there are sacred sites there. I think that's still a matter of discussion, and what at least some on both sides are hoping that they can actually sit down and have a discussion on that.
Where has the federal government come in on this? What requests have been made from the Obama administration so far?
Well, let's start with the fact that the Corps of Engineers has to give a final permit for the pipeline to go under the water, because that in the Missouri River is a navigable river and crosses many state lines. Is more like a national river. The Corps permit has not yet come through. Dakota Access Pipeline has been building, and they want to build all the way up to that point. The Corps and the Obama administration have said, will you please kindly refrain from building the pipeline 20 miles to the west? You know, stop there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a request. That's not an order, because the pipeline company has all the right permits to that point. The real bone of contention, of course, is the water itself.
What has the pipeline company said to that request?
The pipeline company is continuing to build, and it keeps getting closer to the water. So at least that right now they haven't gotten within that 20-mile zone, but could happen very soon. And again, the pipeline company wants to get as much built before winter freeze-up.
We're talking to Dave Thompson of Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota about the protests in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline, where hundreds of people were arrested.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think of protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline? Tell us if you've been involved in any of the protests or are part of the tribes that have supported the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're on the law enforcement side, we'd like to get your thoughts on this too. How do you think the situation has been handled? And do you think that law enforcement is using the right approach with the activists? Our number, 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation with Dave Thompson, news director at Prairie Public Radio. We've been talking about the arrest of 141 people who are protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline.
You can join the conversation by posting on the Central Time Facebook page or calling 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests and what you believe is at stake. Do you think that the federal government should be more involved or should stay out of the matter? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller right away, Dan from Whitewater. Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
What would you like to say?
I read today in the paper that the tribe was offered $15 million to go through the reservation with the pipeline, but they wanted $30 million. So it seems to me it's more about money than anything else. And I do support the tribes with a lot of their controversies, but not really this one. I think it seems to me that it boils down to more money than anything else.
Dave, what about the money here and what the tribe is being offered for this pipeline to go through this area?
That is a very good question because we have been trying to run down some of the things that we've heard. We've heard 5, 10, 15, 20 million. The tribe wanted 20, 25, 30, 35 million. We have not been able to confirm anything on that. It seems to be that really the protests now have been about the idea about fossil fuels. It's grown beyond the pipeline, and a lot of people are saying things like, keep it in the ground. You hear that chant at some of the protests, keep it in the ground. So in terms of the money situation, a tough target to get at. And at this point, I really cannot tell you what is at stake money-wise.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Nate. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Obviously, there is money involved. The fuel industry is one of the largest industries in the country and in the world. And I just see no reason why we should endanger this precious water resource and also cause additional discomfort and stress for these Native American tribes. They've historically been through enough problems. If we can't find a way to get this around this territory without causing problems, then maybe we ought not to be doing it.
And Dave, when you talk to tribal leaders, what are they saying about whether this pipeline needs to be built at all? Couldn't they go elsewhere with it?
That is a good question that I think some people are starting to look at. And I should mention this because there was a serious spill in Montana under the Yellowstone River, and that was a couple of years ago. And I don't know if you remember the floods of 2011, 2012 along in the Missouri-Mississippi system. And there was some scrubbing of the banks, some scrubbing of the river itself, and some change in some of the currents and some of the, depth of the river. And there is some concern that, because no pipeline is 100% safe, that there might be a leak. I know that the Dakota Access Pipeline partner, the Energy Transfer Partners, will tell you that this is the safest pipeline that they could come up with, that there are a lot of safeguards built in, including emergency shutoff valves at both sides. But is it 100% effective? We're not there yet, perhaps.
Well, thank you so much, Nate, for your call. Randy from Reedsburg. Hi, Randy.
Hi, you know what? It's an American company. We're fortunate people still want to invest, I think. I'm a Democrat. I'm an environmentalist, too. It keeps the things from being transported by rail and other dangerous things. On balance, I'm in favor of it. Let them build it, because if we can ensure, let the inspectors do their job, hold them to a high standard. I mean, we built it through permafrost. At this point, nothing is perfect. And we're going to discourage business so much. I mean, once again, I'm a Democrat. Let them build it. I'm in favor of business. Some of us need jobs. I'm just in favor of it now.
And he makes a very good point that nothing is perfect. And I go back to the concerns over the transporting oil by rail and the concerns about putting that on rail cars tip, And even though that they have been made safer, they're not 100% effective either, as nothing is 100%. So the decision has to be made, what's best? Are you going to do it by rail? And the trouble, if you truck oil by rail, there's a premium that the oil is less valuable because they have to discount for transportation costs. Pipeline, there is no technical transportation costs. So there's a lot of things at play here, and my point is there's really no easy answer at this point.
Dave, Randy mentioned jobs. This is a $3.8 billion project. Do you have any estimates on how many jobs it has created in the construction of this pipeline?
I've been told between 10 and 30,000 jobs, but that's not just in North Dakota. That's along the entire route of the pipeline, which goes from North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, into Illinois. So it is a lot of jobs, construction jobs, and unions are definitely in favor of getting this pipeline built because of the jobs.
Let's go to Nancy from La Crosse. Hi, Nancy.
Yes.
What would you like to say?
I'd like to say that I think this is racist because they tried to build it near Bismarck, which is 99% white, and Bismarck said no. And so they moved it to the Native American area. And I think that that's because they know that they can do that to Native Americans, and I think it's shameful.
Dave, has there been that sentiment that you have heard?
I've heard that a lot. And there were reports right away that at least some reports said one of the reasons they didn't build it north of Bismarck Mandan is because of concern about potential water problems. So that came out in some of the reporting, but if you read the entire report that was put together by the regulators, that's one part of it, but not the main part. The main part was concerns about the route itself. Those sentiments are there, and those sentiments are partially to blame for some of the confrontations we've had between law enforcement and the people protesting line.
We're going to leave it there. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today. That was Dave Thompson, news director at Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota. He talked to us about the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, where hundreds of protesters were arrested, some who clashed with police.